want your soul.
Rule number one. The Midnight Mall can be found between 12 a.m. and 3:33 a.m. Guests are welcome inside at any time during this period, but the mall locks its doors promptly at 3:33 a.m. No exceptions. Rule number two. Outside food is welcome anywhere except for the pet store and the funatorium. Rule number three. The cinema's nightly showings start promptly at 12:45 a.m. Once seated, we remind guests not to exit the theater until the end of the credits. Rule number four. There are no refunds, returns, or renegotiations at any of the shops or kiosks inside the Midnight Mall. Rule number five. The security guard makes his rounds between 1:30 and 2 a.m. If you happen to bump into him, do not make eye contact. Rule number six. The janitor works weekends only. If you see him, he will ask you for your help cleaning up a spill. Politely decline. Rule number seven. Shoplifters will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of our laws. Note, each area of the Midnight Mall operates under their own rules and guidelines. Please contact stores individually for a complete list of regulations and opening times. The first time I encountered the Midnight Mall, I hadn't been looking for it. None of us had ever heard of it before, and by us I mean Mike, Remy, Carter, and me, the Frightful Four. That's what we had been calling ourselves for years, ever since a pissed-off substitute had bestowed the title upon us in the seventh grade. She said the four of us together was a teacher's worst fear, and although she had obviously meant it as an insult, it was a moniker we tried our best to live up to. While others, mostly conservative, middle-aged algebra teachers, trembled before us, we aimed to live life to the fullest, never cowering before anything or anyone. In middle school, that meant staying up late, playing Five Nights at Freddy's and watching Nightmare on Elm Street, but as we grew older, we grew more restless, craving adventure, adrenaline, that nighttime feeling, and I guess that's how we found the Midnight Mall. Kind of. Not really. Like I said, at the time we didn't know it existed. We were trying to break into the mall, not to shoplift or vandalize it. We just wanted somewhere to hang out without our parents snooping around. And since Carter was working the closing shift at the food court, he had perfect access to the employees-only back door to sneak us in. Remy had grabbed a half-empty bottle of fruit schnapps from her mom's stash, and Mike had scored a handful of weed gummies. And our plan was to get crossed in the parking lot, wait for Carter to sneak us in, then mess around the empty halls, dodging the janitors and, I don't know, probably daring each other to make out with the faceless mannequins or something stupid. Our lives would have looked a lot different if we had stuck to that plan, or if we had taken the stairs instead of the elevator. If Mike hadn't dared Remy to press the do not touch button on our way up, if it hadn't taken us down onto a lower level that even Carter had never seen before. If I had listened to the awful feeling in my gut and refused to get out. So many ifs, buts, and maybes, but none of that matters. What matters is that we were the Frightful Four, ready to take on the world, and when we stepped out of that elevator and saw a plain wooden door next to a set of rules about something called the Midnight Mall, we looked at each other, laughed, and headed inside. None of us thought it was going to be anything more than a weird prank. What the heck? That's the first thing Carter said when we walked through the door. And I'm pretty sure we were all thinking the same thing. We had been expecting some cramped and dingy storage closet hidden away in a space where almost nobody could find it. Instead, we walked into an exact replica of our mall. At least that's what it looked like. It was as though we had blinked and found ourselves back at the entrance of the first floor. Kiosks, boutiques, the food court up ahead, the layout was a clear copy, and if it weren't for the hordes of people wandering around and enjoying themselves, I would have thought the elevator had glitched and we had simply gone in a weird loop back to the first floor. Again, if. I don't understand, Remy said. What just happened? What is this place? The Midnight Mall, Mike replied, a dopey smile on his face. Duh, didn't you read the sign? I read it just fine, but that doesn't explain this. We were three floors underground. But this place is huge, Remy argued. Mike just shrugged. Kira's right. How would we have gotten back upstairs? Besides, some places build parking garages that go 10 stories lower than we are. This place must have been built by an awesome architect or something. But where did all these people come from? Remy pressed. There were barely any cars in the parking lot. Well, they probably Ubered, Mike said, his nose scrunched up the way it always did when he was annoyed. Or they parked somewhere else so they wouldn't spill the secret. Probably because this place is one of those cool underground finds, a find that we're completely ignoring. Come on, you saw the sign. This place closes at 3:33 a.m. We only have a few hours. Are we really going to spend it arguing about semantics? Us, them, the Frightful Four? Come on. At that, Remy pursed her lips. Although she was the most cautious of us all, she was also the most prideful, and she'd never lived down an accusation of being scared. Come on, Mike said. Let's see what this place has to offer. Eyes wide, we followed Mike a few steps forward to a large directory. There were hundreds of store names written in tiny font, more stores than I thought I could physically fit into a mall, but I didn't recognize most of the names. Not like I had brought much shopping money with me anyways. Why don't we check out the pet store, I recommended, partially because dogs were adorable, but mostly because petting puppies and cuddling kittens cost nothing. That sounds all right, Mike agreed. It's a night mall, so maybe they have some sick nocturnal animals. I've always wanted to pet an owl. I don't know. I'm allergic to cats, Carter said. Then don't pet any cats, Mike said. Why don't we see a movie instead, Remy suggested. She glanced at her watch. We still have 10 minutes before it starts. But movies cost money, I said. Besides, we can watch a movie anywhere. And you can find owls in literally any forest. Like most of our arguments, nobody was keen to switch sides, and so in the end we chose to split up. I know, classic, classic horror movie mistake. But then again, you never think you're in a horror movie until it's too late. At the time, I thought the place was bizarre, but I figured we were in a more surreal Wes Anderson-type situation. So while Carter and Remy went back to check out the cinema, Mike and I headed toward the pet shop. As we made our way through the crowds of people, I couldn't help but notice that a lot of out-of-towners had made their way to this strange attraction. My town wasn't small by any stretch, but it wasn't New York City either. We rarely had tourists, and yet every few feet I heard people speaking French, Mandarin, Spanish, and the styles were strange too. Although the majority of people looked normal enough, some wore trailing Victorian dresses or steampunk attire. The Midnight Mall, I mused. My thoughts were growing hazier as the edibles kicked in. Maybe that's why everything felt so surreal and dreamlike. You think we stumbled on some sort of Comic-Con, I said. Maybe, Mike said. But I could tell he wasn't really listening. We had made it to the pet store, and all of his attention was now focused on finding the coolest birds of prey. As Mike roamed the aisles, I looked around the front of the store. The aisles were lined with boxes of treats, toys, and fro-fro outfits, and there were tons of wire cages housing puffy-cheeked hamsters, sleeping kittens, and sad-looking dogs. I headed closer to the dogs. There were only three or four in the cages, and all of them perked up when I took a step forward. A few of them whined in anticipation. Poor things. I wondered how long they had waited there, hoping someone would stop and take them to their forever home. Although the mall was quite crowded, we were the only customers in the pet shop, so it didn't seem like they got much business. It must be a lonely life in here, huh, guys? I said. And it must have been my imagination, but I could have sworn the golden retriever closest to me actually nodded his head. Eyebrows raised, I stepped even closer. I had watched over my neighbor's golden retriever a few months ago, and this one looked nearly identical to that one except for the eyes. They were a light green color, half covered by the dog's matted hair, and bore straight into my own. I couldn't have explained it to you, but somehow those eyes looked more intelligent than any other dog's eyes I had seen before. More perceptive, more analytical, more human. I reached a hand towards the cage, just as Mike squeezed my shoulder, hard. "What's with the grip, dude?" I demanded, twisting around. But my attitude short-circuited when I realized that Mike was nowhere to be seen. Instead, an intimidatingly tall and gaunt man stared down at me with blank, sunken eyes. His pale, almost graying skin made it look like he hadn't stepped foot into the sun or perhaps out of his shop in months. And I know you shouldn't judge a book by its cover, but man, I was looking at a Nosferatu look-alike, especially since his yellowing fingernails were currently digging quarter moons into my shoulders. I jerked away from him. Excuse me, sir, I said, trying to sound more annoyed than nervous. Can I help you? No touching. Yeah, I would appreciate that very much. No touching the animals, he clarified. Oh, I said, some of my indignance deflated. Sorry, do you work here? Yes, I'm the curator, he said. The curator, you mean? You mean like you decide what animals to buy for the store? The man's lips thinned. I couldn't tell if he was unhappy or if he was suppressing a smile. Something like that, he said. I didn't like his tone, but before I could press or ask him how much the golden retriever was, I heard Mike scream. A howling, terrified scream. I had never heard that kind of desperation in his voice before. Without thinking, I sprinted away, deeper into the store, and then skidded to a stop. I took a short, shallow breath, my legs frozen with fear. Because something was eating Mike. I said something because whatever the animal was, I had never seen anything like it before. It had a long, slithering tail like a rat, the matted fur of a hyena, and the head of a vulture. And it was that long, thin vulture's beak that was reaching through a gap in its cage to gouge strips of skin from Mike's thigh. The nightmarish creature tore another long line of flesh from Mike's thigh as easily as if his skin was a fruit roll-up peeling off the bone. Mike jerked forward, but before he could move an inch, the creature speared him once more with its beak. Ah! Mike yelled, his body convulsing as he tried desperately to escape. As he shook, his head jerked to the left and we made eye contact. Kira! Kira, help me! With a burst of adrenaline, I rushed forward, grabbing Mike's arms and tugging him forward, but the bird wasn't finished. Threatened by my presence, it clammed its massive beak over Mike's ankles. When I pulled, its beak pressed down harder, hard enough that Mike's curses became an incessant wail, painfully loud and just as animalistic as any of the other creatures in the store. Crunch. Splinters of yellow-white bone shard rose through Mike's skin like cheese pushed through a grater. In some distant corner of my mind, I was ready to panic vomit, but I worked in autopilot. My mind was going blank as I played tug-of-war with the bird. The creature was stronger than me, but as I pulled, it yanked more flesh from Mike's foot, allowing me just enough wiggle room to pull him backwards. We both fell to the floor, gasping, but there was no time to rest. Mike's ankle was already a purple, swollen mess decorated with bone splinters, and his left thigh looked even worse. Blood, gasping muscle tissue, tendons shredded like plucked piano chords, holding in the urge to vomit, I tore off my cardigan and pressed it to the wound. But with the amount of blood he was losing, I knew that wasn't going to be nearly enough to help him. Help, I yelled. Someone help us. My gaze darted back and forth down the aisles, searching for the curator, but he was nowhere to be seen. Apparently touching the dogs was a criminal offense, but customers being pecked to death wasn't his problem. I gritted my teeth. Mike was in no condition to walk, but I had to get him to a hospital, and fast. I would let myself think about how insane the situation was after that. Placing both my arms underneath his pits, I pulled him backwards with a grunt. If he made it out of here alive, no, when I chastened myself, I was going to tell him to go on a juice cleanse. Just hold on, I said, you're going to be okay. Another step backwards, his blood smeared against the tiles, and the vulture let out an enraged squawk. Although it had eaten nearly a quarter of Mike's leg, apparently it had room for second. At the sound of the avian cry, Mike gave a harsh whine, his body convulsing in my hold. I tried my best to make soothing noises, even as I jerked him toward the entrance, his ankle bones skidding across the floor in a way that was probably not the most comfortable for him. It's okay, I repeated. You're going to be okay. He craned his neck to look at me, his gaze distinctly not okay. The gummies, he whispered, his voice hoarse from his screams. They were in my back pocket. Right, right, that thing must have ate them. But I wouldn't worry about that right now, I said. No, he said, the gummies, the rules. Don't bring food into the pet store. He looked up at me with a helpless, haunted expression that I had only seen twice in his life. Once when his younger sister died in a car accident, and again 2 years later after his parents divorced from the stress. Now he looked up at me with the exact same expression and said, Kira, where the hell are we? And then he passed out. Mike, Mike, I shook him, but he was out cold. He was running out of time. Dang it. Pressing my hand against his shredded, weeping skin, I tugged with all my might, finally managing to pull him out of the store. But I hadn't made it more than 3 feet when my back hit a sturdy, muscular wall. You seem to have caused quite the commotion, little lady. Maybe I could be of some help, someone said. And that's when I turned around and slowly looked up at the security guard. Holding on to Mike like a lifeline, I slowly twisted around. The first thing I noticed were the man's shoes. Those thick black combat boots probably saved my life. Running off adrenaline, my first impulse was to look up into the eyes of the man, but the dullness of his shoes caught my attention. They appeared to be somewhat new, but were already scuffed to bits. With growing trepidation, my gaze darted from his boots to his dark trousers to the shiny security badge fastened to his lapel. That's when I remembered the rule number 5. The security guard makes his rounds between 1:30 and 2 a.m. If you happen to bump into him, do not make eye contact. I swallowed, my mouth going cotton dry now. Well, the guard said, can I help you? It took me a moment to find my voice. Part of me wanted to turn tail and flee, but I knew Mike was running out of time, and even though he could be a bit of a jerk sometimes, I also knew he wouldn't hesitate to do everything he could do to help me in a situation like this. So keeping my gaze level with the security guard's chest, I nodded. My friend, I choked out, he's hurt. I can see that, he said. I flinched as the guard bent down, but he didn't try and meet my gaze. He appeared to be examining Mike's wounds. Looks like a nasty chimera bite. You didn't happen to bring outside food into the pet store, did you? My silence was answer enough. Didn't you read the rules? He asked, his voice heavy with disapproval. Yes, but, I hesitated. But what? But I forgot Mike had a few gummies in his pocket. That might have been true, but it wasn't the full truth. Because even if I had remembered, I don't think I would have done anything different. Not at the time. But I didn't think anything would actually happen was closer to reality. Only I doubted that was what the guard wanted to hear. But is it really the time for a lecture? I asked instead. You said you could help, and I don't know how much time Mike has. He's literally bleeding out in front of you. I know, the guard sighed. I'll have to call the janitor. Although I knew better than to look him in the eyes, the guard must have seen how red my face was turning, because with a low grumble, he whipped a notebook out of his pocket and scrawled something down. Fine, I'll take it from here, he said. You just focus on getting out of here before the night's end. Then he pressed a little black button on his belt and proceeded to reach down for Mike. For a moment, my grip tightened. Wait. The guard ignored me, lifting Mike out of my hands as easily as if he were a loaf of bread and breaking my hold like I was one of those disposable ties wrapped around the loaf. I grabbed onto his bicep and tugged, dizzy with panic. Wait, I repeated. What are you going to do with him? I don't know if I can save him, but I'll do what I can, he said. But where are you going? I asked. I hated the desperate shrillness in my voice. If Mike had been conscious, he would have laughed at me and told me that I sounded like the first girl to die in a B-list horror movie. Where are you taking him? Somewhere you don't want to follow, the guard said, and although it was hard to gauge without looking up at his expression, I thought he sounded almost sympathetic. But I just can't leave him, I said. That's my friend. And I'll do everything I can to help him, the guard said, but it's like you said. He doesn't have much time, and while I'm happy to continue our conversation, he might not like that so much. I bit my lip. How could I argue with logic? Easy answer, I couldn't. Instead, I watched as the security guard disappeared into the crowd, leaving nothing of Mike behind but a trail of his blood. So much dang blood. Could a person really live through something like that? Lost in my morbid thoughts, I stayed rooted in place, staring numbly forward. It wasn't until I heard a wet, squelching sound behind me that I came back to my senses. There was an elderly janitor mopping the blood off the floor, his expression exhausted. "Now that's a nasty spill," he said. "Yeah, sorry about that." "I don't suppose you'd be able to lend a hand, would you?" the janitor asked, rubbing his lower back. He gave me a pitiful, hopeful look. He had the exact appearance of a kind elderly neighbor, as if I hadn't remembered rule number 6. If the janitor asked for your help cleaning up a spill, politely decline. I would have given in without thinking. Only I did know the rules, and knowing the rules, I was able to look a fraction deeper than his surface expression. And underneath that sweet, cajoling look was a world of hunger. The janitor was famished. For what? I'm not sure. But I have the feeling that had I helped him, I would have found out immediately. "Sorry," I murmured. "I'm a little busy." I hesitated, half waiting for something heinous to happen to me, but the janitor just rolled his eyes and went back to mopping, grumbling about the youth and their lack of work ethic. My eyes fluttered shut in relief, and I gave myself a mental pat on the back. Things were finally starting to calm down. Mike was with someone who could help him, at least. That's what I told myself, what I needed to believe, and I was starting to acclimate to the Midnight Mall's rules. Although the past hour had been harrowing, I would make sure that I didn't make any more mistakes. But that's when I realized it wasn't me I had to worry about. I straightened up with a jolt. Remy and Carter. Oh, crap. I had been so focused on Mike, I had almost forgotten that Remy and Carter were still somewhere in this demented place. No, not somewhere. I knew exactly where they were. Praying that they were still in their seats, I hightailed it towards the movie theater. The mall was loud with the sound of shuffling footsteps, shrieks of laughter, and vendors hawking their goods at cluttered kiosks, but I tuned it all out, my mind in a daze. I only noticed the noise when I burst into the lobby of the movie theater and realized that everything had gone utterly silent. I slowed to an uneasy stop. The scent of a freshly buttered popcorn wafted through the room, filling me with a sense of nostalgia and safety. But like the rest of the mall, there was something uncanny about this place. The linoleum floors were a tad too shiny, that popcorn scent a little too perfect. Not to mention, the lobby was completely abandoned, not a soul in sight, or so I thought. "We're not selling tickets anymore." I hadn't made it a step past the ticket kiosk when someone slunk out from behind the popcorn machine. The sudden movement made me gasp, although the employee who emerged looked innocuous enough. She was a young woman around my age, and her diamond nose ring and dyed hair made her appear comfortingly familiar, a woman from my own time. "I'm not looking for a ticket," I explained. "I'm just trying to find my friends." "Well, if you want to get inside, you need a ticket," the woman said, her voice bored. "And like I said, we're not selling those anymore," she said. "But I have to. Please, it's urgent," I explained. "My friends, Remy and Carter, they came here to watch a movie earlier, and I have to make sure they're okay. It's our first time here, and I'm worried that they're not taking this place seriously, that they think it's a joke. But I know it's not a joke, because our other friend Mike, much to my shame, that's when I started crying. And not a few dainty tears either. No, I was full-on ugly sobbing in the middle of the movie theater lobby, my shoulders shaking, my voice trembling, and my eyes a-glaring red from a combination of the crying and the edibles. It was strange. I had kept it together during Mike's mauling, but now that I wasn't in any immediate danger, I was like a faucet with no tap. And although I knew I looked totally pathetic, I couldn't stop the torrent. Maybe that's what made the woman take pity on me. "Oh, hey now, don't cry," she said, patting my back awkwardly, suddenly looking more out of place than me. "It's okay, you're okay." "But what if one of my friends left the theater?" I asked through a horrific combination of snot and tears. "What would happen to them?" The woman, who I had started to think of solely as nose ring, tugged at her pink bangs. "Well, the cinema would sort them out," she said, "but let's not think about that. Look, the movie started at 12:45 and it'll be done at 2:45. It's 2:30 now. That's only 15 minutes you have to wait. You can do 15 minutes, can't you?" I licked my dry lips uncertainly. "You can do 15 minutes, she said. A command this time. Because no offense, but if you're this worried about your friends leaving before the movie ends, you wouldn't want to know what happens to the people who go inside without a ticket. Now have a seat and stay there," she instructed, pointing at a stool. "I'll be right back." True to her word, The woman left and came back a moment later with a large soda. She instructed me to drink. The sugar will help with your nerves. I did as she said, relieved to have someone else telling me what to do. In the span of a minute or two, I had gulped down half the cup. There, she said. That better? I nodded, surprising myself. The soda was cool and refreshing, and although it didn't make anything better, somehow the act of focusing on something as mundane as drinking through a straw calmed me. I felt a little bit more in control of the situation, and a lot more embarrassed about my reaction as well. Yeah, thank you. Sorry about that. Don't worry about it, nose ring shrugged. I've been working here for years now. You get used to it. Years? I looked her up and down. She looked like a senior in high school. How young did this place recruit? Only before I could ask nose ring that question, or any of the other hundred that were now coming to mind, there was a crackling sound and a voice came through like a walkie-talkie on her belt. Cleanup needed an auditorium too. Do you copy? Nose ring wrinkled her nose. She looked like she was maybe thinking about ignoring the summons, but then the walkie-talkie buzzed for a second time. She sighed. Copy that, she said. She glanced at me. I have to go take care of something. Will you be okay? Yeah, I'll be fine, I said. Thanks again, Trish, she says. Thanks, Trish. Nose ring, I mean Trish, gave me an awkward pat on the shoulder before hurrying off. I glanced at the clock on the wall, 2:40 a.m. Just 5 more minutes to go, I could do this. That's why I was surprised when only a few moments had passed when I heard a creak from around the hall. A door opened. I twisted around and saw a small crowd trickle out of the auditorium. There were only about 5 or 6 people, and I spotted Remy at the forefront. When I waved, she made a beeline towards me. Remy, I'm so glad you're okay, I said, looping my arms around her neck and pulling her close. You won't believe what I've been through. This place, you were right, it's not normal. Trust me, I know, Remy said, and that's when I noticed her expression. My stomach dropped. Although Remy was the most risk-averse out of all of us, she also sported the best poker face. She had grown up with 3 older brothers who teased her mercilessly about everything, and because of this, hiding her true emotions had become a basic instinct for her. But now, well, now she looked scared. And if Remy was scared, then she must actually be terrified. A bad feeling swirling in the pit of my stomach, I craned my head around the ticket counter, gazing down the hall and towards the auditorium. But although there were still more people trickling out, I didn't see Carter anywhere. Remy, where's Carter? Remy just shook her head. Rems, we have to get out of here, she said, ignoring my question. Come on. Without waiting for an answer, Remy seized my hand and dragged me out of the movie theater. She moved so fast that I had to jog to keep up. We were halfway to the mall's exit before I came to my senses. I snatched my hand back, forcing Remy to pause. Wait, slow down a second, I said. What happened? I don't have time to explain. We have to leave now, she said. But Remy, wait, we can't just leave. The hell we can't. Come on, Kira. This place is a madhouse. It's a steel trap dressed in pretty colors and you're shuffling around like bait. Now let's go. She grabbed my hand again and attempted to yank me towards the door, but I dug my heels into the floor. Mike and Carter are still somewhere inside, I argued, and you haven't even heard about what happened to Mike. He was attacked, Remy, mauled by some nightmare creature, and I don't even know if he's alive. And what about Carter? We can't just abandon them. I'm not trying to be rude, she said. What happened to Mike and Carter is awful. But if we don't get out of here, we're going to end up just like them. Is that what you want? She said. I hesitated. Part of me was so loyal to the Frightful Four that I wanted to scream at Remy for even suggesting such a thing. But Remy had always been the most sensible of all of us. When she argued for something, 9 times out of 10, she was the one in the right. And as much as I hated to leave Mike and Carter behind, I didn't want to forfeit our lives either. Sensing my indecision, Remy clutched my hands in her own and stared into my eyes, her expression softening. Please, Kiera, come with me. It's already 3 a.m. I know it sounds harsh, but we don't have much time and I'm scared. I'm so scared, Kiera. I am terrified. Her voice was thick with fear, raw with vulnerability. And it was that, more than anything else, that finally did it, finally made me realize. Remy would never admit to being scared, I said. Heart pounding, I took a single step away from this thing calling herself Remy. Or at least I tried, but she was still clutching my hands in her grip, a grip that grew increasingly harsh, pressing down on the fragile bones in my hand until, crack, a whimper escaped me. The Remy imposter chuckled, pleased with my pain. You're right. The one you call Remy hid her emotions very well. She leaned in closer to me, her blunt teeth snapping next to my earlobe, which made it all the more satisfying to collect her scream. She gave me an appraising, hungry look. Then she smiled. But your screams? Oh, I can already tell they're going to be divine. And then, gripping my broken hand like a vice, the Remy imposter pushed me towards the exit.